This is a conspiracy. That's what this is. One big damn conspiracy! And everyone's in on it! I know what's going on.
Did IQs just drop sharply while I was away?
The person is smart. People are dumb, panicky, dangerous animals, and you know it.
Did you see the memo about this?
Just when I think you couldn't possibly be any dumber, you go and do something like this.
Don't you see what this means? This is it! This is the beginning of everything! I've been waiting for this all my life!
Welcome to episode 62 of Your Missing the Point podcast, where we discuss the weird, the wonderful, and the downright bizarre aspects of life, as we have conversations with people from all over the world. Today I'm joined by two guests. One lives off in a faraway foreign land, a man who truly encompasses that of a gentleman and a scholar. He is an articulate, well-informed, and intellectual that carries himself with humility. And the other is Fozzie. But seriously, gentlemen, glad to have you guys here. If it wasn't for Fozzie, I wouldn't have been introduced to this new guest to the show, Raiden. Raiden, Fozzie, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
I was convinced you were going to introduce Fozzie there, so I was waiting to see what you were going to say about me. And then you
clicked
on me.
No, yeah, the listeners are very familiar with Fozzie at this point. He's the gentleman that jumps on. We both get into schizo rants about any God-given subject.
Yeah.
On end.
And never get the answer.
And never get the answer. We just keep rambling, going around in circles. But here we are. We've got a gentleman who will keep us on track, hopefully, here for a great conversation. Raiden, you're joining us from the UK. Fozzie, you're in India. And here I am in Australia. Where would we be as little as 10 years ago without this technology? This couldn't occur. So let's thank the powers that be with the technocracy and the technology elite of the world for this wonderful, wonderful device that we have now.
Yeah, I love having just something that just permeates radiation into my genitals every day.
That's how just Spider-Man got his powers, though, right?
Keep it in my pocket. I think there was a spider involved, but, you know, maybe someone will,
And here I was just praising the benefits of technology.
Their phone in their pocket.
And Fozzie's rubber band and like, oh. And he's turned his camera off, people. It's okay. This is a audio-only podcast anyway, so you're not missing a lot. Not to say that Fozzie's not on the handsome side, but we need to hear his voice. That's the most important thing. Raiden, how are you going, my friend?
Yeah, not too bad, mate. Not too bad. Just watching from abroad, I thought lunacy was only in the UK. The aftermath of what's been going on, but unfortunately you guys down there, and I'm counting Fozzie as down there, even if he is in it far from his perspective, I'm just watching you decide to go in parts unknown and territories that frankly a normal human mind should never ever enter, as far as I'm concerned. The dystopia akin to something sci-fi, and as somebody who's a regular visitor to your country and hopefully will resurrect that later on this year, I'm aghast every time I read anything about Australia, what's happening, the mindset, but I'm sure we'll get into it. But yeah, other than that, not too bad.
Well, that's good. At least other people are recognising it. It's not just people like me in this country who are called cookers and crazy conspiracy theorists. What we are talking about, of course, is the most recent horrible thing to happen in our country, the digital ID passing. So for those people in the international world who don't know what this is, this is essentially a single shop source for all your information online. So whether you're searching the internet, applying for a job, setting up an account, what have you, all your data is going to be in one singular source, which of course is pitched as a convenient thing that you don't have to upload 100 points of ID to do things. You just have your centralized ID that's all kept together. How convenient, how amazing. Although, this isn't a new idea. This was actually proposed to Australia back in 1987 for the Australia card. And lo and behold, people of the 1980s knew how horrible and authoritarian this could potentially be. And they knocked it on its head pretty quickly. It was pushed away like the Viking burial, set off blaze and sent off to the horizon to never be seen again until now. And here we are living with it, with the majority of Australians thinking it's going to be great because it will make a digital society much easier to attain and a much better place for a cashless world. And they don't seem to see any potential horrible outcomes of these at all.
You know, sorry, just to check before Fozzy starts. You know what the problem I have is that there's two aspects to this. Well, you've alluded to the governmental side. We'll talk about that in a minute. It's the way that not just stuff like this, but in general, and you know, you've just been advocating the positive benefits of the internet technology, and they're, you know, it's difficult to turn around and challenge and argue against it. But of course, the problem is people are now so reliant on digital technology. Phones, devices, everything else. I mean, I've even heard them called third and fourth hands of people or arms, whatever you want to call it. And the problem I think we're facing is that in the name of convenience, which for me is the new God, you can pretty much get people to sacrifice anything. And that is very, very disturbing because at the end of the day, forgive me for being old fashioned, I always thought convenience was supposed to facilitate and make life easier. Not to allow pernicious things to come into the environment and ensure that people can essentially be exploited along with their sensitive data all over the shop. I don't know what you guys think.
Yeah, I think what the government is doing with the digital ID, I mean, obviously it's not ending here. Like the line's just going to continue being pushed into a more authoritarian stance than what it currently is. I think for the average day Australian, like, you know, the people that just, you know, not to like disenfranchise or, you know, dismiss them, but the average Australian that probably just, you know, goes, does 9 to 5, comes home, watches reality TV and the news and has something for dinner and, you know, does that on repeat 7 days a week. I think for them, the idea of digital currency is an easy pill to swallow because it's, at the end of the day, convenience is a really attractive selling point to the average like person. But obviously, you know, we know what the ultimate outcome of the digital ID system is when you have complete control of someone's entire life, including all their personal information, all their online data profiles, you know, what the government does with that data, you know, sells it off to marketing agencies and organizations, and you know, those organizations then use that for discourse shaping and, you know, sort of molding the societal framework at the behest of how the government wishes it to be molded into. That becomes scaring. I don't even know what the word is to use. That becomes so worrisome for the future of that society that I don't even think that the individuals that have no issue with it from the citizen standpoint realize long-term what that system is going to ultimately become. But, you know, as it currently stands, we're still going to be the cookers for the next 5 years until the majority actually see the outcomes of those choices and policies that have been put in. And it's just, it's really worrisome for Australia, man. Like for me, obviously I'm living in India, but I'm still an Australian citizen at the end of the day. You know, I still have to vote. There's things that I still have to partake in. I'm still a taxpayer for, you know, Australia as a whole. But man, like, I don't even want to be a part of the system anymore, seeing where it's moved into. And it's just, it's almost like all the citizens of Australia that are participating online, that are trying to get their voices out to discuss these things, whether that is through abusive messages on politicians' Twitter posts, whether that's through DMs, whether that's through Twitter spaces or Instagram reels, TikTok, whatever it might be, it just seems like the politicians are being willfully ignorant of it and not really caring what the citizens think. Like at the end of it all, it's like it really comes down to like how many votes they get, right? So as long as they keep the minor parties happy, then like, you know, then everyone's happy at the end of the day. And I know we'll obviously speak about minor parties soon because there's an issue in Australia that I've got a bit of a gripe with right now. But yeah, anyway, I've rambled on for enough.
I don't think it's a willful ignorance of politicians. Like, the digital ID was going to happen.
I'm being nice.
They knew it was going to happen. They told us back in 2017, we have a digital ID bill, and it's going to come in halfway through the year of 2024. Here we are.
Yeah.
It's roughly halfway through 2024, and it just so happens to pass now. Sorry, they're kind of pre-telling us what they're intending to do. One of the big concerns is that when it comes to digital ID, it's not just it in itself. It's how it gives and bolsters powers in other areas like disinformation, misinformation bill, taxation. One of the biggest things that knocked the Australia card on its head was people were worried about the government being able to tax you for everything you do. Now, if we throw in a cashless society in the next few years where everything is accessible by a click of a mouse for governments, the tax man, the ATO, there's no way of avoiding taxation. If anything, they're going to find all the little things that you've been getting away with for a long time and get more tax out of you. The tax cow is going to be absolutely sucked dry at the milking stool, and they're going to have insights into our lives that humans have never had before. This is like the Magna Carta on crack. It's an idea that the king's gone out, checked everyone in his kingdom, figures out how many cows you got, how many chickens, and can tax you accordingly. But this has gone beyond that. This has gone into a digital world, inside our homes, inside our pockets. It will know. It's like an entity in itself. It's going to know the ins and outs of your life, what you're doing, when, and where. This sets a very dangerous precedent, not just in taxation, but in the political and cultural discussion as a whole. What happens if a charismatic leader gets in, has some biased views against a particular demographic, theology, religious group, racial group, what have you, and uses the powers that are put in place by a digital ID to pinpoint people, where they live, how to collect them, and do away with them? Now, I always tend to go to the polar dangerous side of things, the polar opposite of what the convenience is. I always go to the most catastrophic end and work my way back, because I like to know what's the most dangerous possible thing could come out of any government decision, because then we can see the few steps that incrementalism that leads up to it. And I don't think that a nationalized digital ID combined with a lot of the other things that are coming Australia's way lead anywhere pretty. And at very least, it becomes a very authoritarian state in which your speech is policed, you're taxed to the gills, and your life is constantly monitored. That would give Aldous Huxley a raging heart on.
I mean, gentlemen, you've both spoken about the pernicious side of it, and that's clearly relevant. But you have to twin that up with the incompetent side of it, because there aren't any governments, as far as I see, certainly democratic, which don't get extremely good marks if we were marking them, the incompetence in their ability to completely balls things up, if I can put it that way. And so when you've got the pernicious side, which you just identified there, Drew, as well as the propensity of governments to be able to be, should we say, loose with information and loose with things, it is, you know, it is the darkest dystopia you can possibly imagine. People throw things around like Orwell all over the shop. But this really, really is beyond the pale, because I'll share a quick anecdote with you, because I'm pretty sure I'm older than both of you. Obviously, for my teens, we never had the internet. So I thankfully knew a world where this sort of stuff didn't exist and you could actually have a bit of anonymity. My background was obviously in law, and this is where I became, you know, really concerned about liberty and everything else. I mean, you'll be familiar. I think that in the early 2000s, in the aftermath of 9/11, one of the discussions that governments across the world were having was the ability to detain terrorists and essentially suspend habeas corpus, which is just frankly ridiculous, because at the end of the day, you know, there are reasons that those things exist, and, you know, everybody has to have due process, whether they're alleged to be a criminal or whether they're, you know, got allegations which ultimately prove to be false, whichever way it goes. But, you know, so I lived through that as well, and thankfully sanity prevailed. But on the anecdote I was going to share with you is from about 10 years ago. And I was coming back from work, and my other half said to me she wanted me to get something from the local supermarket. So I went in and, you know, as you can imagine, who goes into a supermarket and just buys one thing? I go, nobody. The difference being obviously men buy about two or three, women buy the whole shop. But let's not go there. But the problem with it was, so I bought a couple of other things, right? Whatever she wanted, it was like a fiver, and I ended up spending about 20 odd quid. And then I remember because I had about 30 quid on me, so I had a little bit of change. Nothing untoward, went home, end off. This was on a Wednesday evening, and I remember this. On the Saturday, gentlemen, this is what I'm about to tell you is disturbing, because this was by a cash transaction. God only knows what they would have done with a card. What happened was Saturday, my other half of my mum went into the supermarket, and the manager there knew them. And he alluded to the fact that I had gone in and come in on the Wednesday, obviously at the behest of my other half, and proceeded to pull up all the items that I'd bought because he recognized me from 2.5 days ago. And you know what really got to me was, I mean, look, at the end of the day, I wasn't doing anything untoward or buying a third one, but, and it's a big but, for argument's sake, say I was. That would be my choice to make as an adult. It would be anybody else's choice to make. What right? And the crazy thing was, I don't think he was doing this with any malicious intent. I think he was just doing it just for a bit of a laugh or because he knew them. But exactly what you've just said, that technology and that ability to come into 2024 would just be devastating. And I'll twin it with this. When I was in China at the beginning of the year, we were crossing the Hong Kong border with China. We were walking through, and one of the guys with me was stopped. And the Chinese, basically, the authorities gathered around him, about 8 or 10 of them. And, you know, we're trying to motion him over. And he didn't speak any Cantonese. And I, you know, mine was conversational anyway. So I got over and I started to ask him, you know, what's the situation? And you're not going to believe this. They have these, I didn't know this either because I haven't been for a few years. They had these cameras which were monitoring people essentially crossing the border from Hong Kong into Shenzhen. And what I was completely aghast about, he'd been identified on three of these cameras, and they allowed me to look at the picture, and he looked, believe it or not, a bit like a man with a big Santa Claus beard. And they identified that his temperature was irregular. So they motioned him across, told him to go and get temperature checks done, and wouldn't allow him to enter China until they were satisfied that A, he didn't have Wuhan virus, as I call it, and B, that he wasn't ill. I mean, I thought irony was dead when the Chinese were checking foreigners for Wuhan virus coming into China, but that's a different kettle of fish. But that's where the dystopia leads. And it is so concerning. We talk about convenience, Drew, and that's one thing. But it's almost as if the stuff which is concealed, which is being implemented day by day, whether it's traffic monitoring, whether it's transaction monitoring, whether in this case it's just simply monitoring you, who doesn't get ill every now and then? You know, that's what our immune systems have got. For me, that's the problem, that a lot of it we see, but there's a heck of a lot of it that we just simply don't. And nobody from any country, whether it's yours, whether it's here, whether it's elsewhere, seems to be bothered or, you know, really raising a sustained voice to say, hold on, what the hell's going on?
Yeah, there's also another aspect of it. You said that there's like the negligence and the incapability of governments not to fuck up, essentially, which they always do. We've been sold for the last 12 months in Australia, so they've been putting the legwork in, which is very smart of them, that, you know, your data online needs to be kept safe because we've had Medibank Private, we've had Telstra, we've had Optus, who have been hacked and all your data and your information has been stolen. Oh no, but the government, we can keep it safe. What's a safer place than a honeypot of everyone's digital information in one central location, which is run by the government? Surely that can't be hacked by anyone. Not at all. What's to stop, say, I don't know, the criminal underworld hacking people, finding out where, I don't know, maybe vintage cars are kept and they get everyone's address and then go on a robbing spree, find out where certain individuals live to target certain people. If you've got all your data, all your private information kept in one source that, wrongly or rightly, is being held by the government, that's literally a honeypot. Everything's in one spot. And I don't trust the government to be able to keep that safe. The government couldn't even keep us safe during the Wu flu, apparently. So, you know, they were the worst danger. The virus didn't really do anything. They were the most dangerous thing. So, yes, there's element. There's the dangerous apocalyptic nature of this. There's the absolute failures of government, which can make things worse, because we know criminals will always find a way to do things. So it just seems like it's a bad idea all around.
You know what I've noticed with these like rollouts of digital IDs globally not just Australia, but globally. There's been one point of conversation with these rollouts that's been completely devoid in social settings. And that's the transparency of how the data is used by the government and the transparency of the accessibility to that data by the individuals. So, and on top, like right now, the digital ID in Australia, I believe, is for 18 and over. But we know that the government loves to push the social pens, the government social pens, into different groups, and that doesn't dismiss age groups as well.
No, well, Fozzie, you're describing the current conversation, which is going on at the same time as digital ID. That's keeping children safe on the internet. How do we ensure children under the age of 16 are safe online? If only there was something like a digital ID which they could use to ensure we knew their age and they couldn't access these things.
I'm going to hire the best, smartest woman in the world and she's going to do the job just perfectly. Have you heard about this Julianne Grant? She used to work at Twitter. I'm going to get her. She looks like she knows what she's doing. She doesn't look evil at all. Like, it's just crazy.
A woman that turned down a role at the CIA. I'm sorry, no one turns down a role at the CIA then ends up being the truth czar in another nation. That's not at all suspicious.
It's just sad, dude, because, like, you know, I've obviously spoken on Twitter Space, or X Spaces, sorry, about, like, transparency. I don't know, I've mentioned it a bunch of times, and any time I've mentioned the question to a particular politician or anyone who walks within those political, you know, circles and circuits, they never get the answers. Like, it's like you just try to dismiss the root problem that I raise. And I generally ask, like, you know, I'll put a little bit of context in it, but generally I ask a pretty direct question. And, man, it frustrates the crap out of me that people that are adherents to political edict or to governmental edict just – it's like their brains, and now I'm not even digging at the politicians. Now I'm just digging at the general people that, like, have no issue with the current politicians that run the operation, that run the show. And they've just got no quarrel in the world when it comes to government overreach, government oversight. But I also think, you know, when I mentioned about, like, that willful ignorance thing, yeah, you're right, like, on the government side of things, because it's not entirely willfully ignorant. I don't think it's entirely ignorant. Some of it I genuinely believe is intentional. Those intentions, I think, are deep-rooted in another issue that exists within many Western governments, and that's the relationship between Western governments and foreign organisations. I know in India recently, India blocked out 7,000 NGOs because they were receiving foreign aid, and some of those NGOs, it wasn't just foreign aid. There was within the NGOs, there was a lot of black market sort of work that was going on, like avoidance of taxation and stuff like that. But there was about 500 NGOs out of that 7,000 group that were receiving foreign investments for sowing negative discord across the social status, or across the social stratosphere, I could say. And I wonder, when we look at the West and the relationship that governments have with these organizations and how much money gets injected into the organizations via foreign governments or via the government that the organization is operating next to and within that country, I think it's a scary thought when you see what happens on the streets. So in Australia, and I know across the entirety of the West, what's happening right now, obviously with this Israel Gaza or Jews versus Muslims thing, I'm not even going to sugarcoat it because that's what it is. It seems like when you've got organizations like the Australian Friends of Palestine Advocacy Group and the Palestine Australian Networking Group, that are these organizations that have existed for a long time. Like, these go back to, like, 2008. These aren't, like, new organizations, at least in Australia. And they're receiving foreign funding, and that funding is then being injected into these Telegram groups, these WhatsApp groups that are then getting thousands of people to go and protest at universities, protest outside of government buildings, protest on the streets, and cause general anarchy. And I know you will hear the argument where they'll go, like, oh, they're all peaceful protests. Well, not by the video footage that I've seen. It doesn't really seem that peaceful. but they're allowed to continue. And the government's just full. And I know I'm specifically targeting that. I could. It doesn't matter which group it is. It could be neo-Nazi groups. It could be any particular group that is being funded by these organizations. The fact that the governments aren't willing to open up their own books and shine a light on organizations that are actually sowing dissent and negative discourse in society is another big problem that I have. And it all comes back to that idea of transparency, and the governments are just failing that bar at every stretch.
You just described useful idiots, and that's what I see happening across the West in general. Because you know what? I agree. 30,000 odd innocent civilians dying in a conflict is too much. One dead civilian is too much, in my opinion.
Yep.
So I do empathize with these people. I get that. But I find it very odd and very coincidental that these protests kick off in Australia while the national conversation is about disinformation, misinformation, the legal right to protest, and the digital ID.
Yep.
We have a left-wing government in power, which normally would be supporting these people. And at the moment, they're showing up the coalition. They're showing conservatives how to stand up against their own government. The people that they vote for, they're going up against their government. So they're this useful idiot group that, like you said, because of NGOs, non-government organizations, and these groups that are funding them, it's like they're deliberately doing this so they can sow discontent and division in the community to get the conversation around something needs to be done about these protesters. You know, it's too dangerous. There should be laws around protesting. They should have to do this. They should have to do that. And everyone's going to jump on board because they've picked one side or the other. And then laws are going to pass. Laws that are going to pass that will stop us from assembling and protesting against government overreach, against government decisions and choices. It's going to stop us from saying certain things, certain words. It's going to make 18C, yeah, hate speech laws in this state and across the country much, much stronger. And ultimately, it's going to come around to bite the people who support these incoming things in the ass, because those same things will be used against them as a weapon. The pen is mightier than the sword, and we're inking the pen up for them at this point through all these useful idiots.
I'm glad, Drew, you made the point, because Fozzie went on to the sort of, I think there's two strands to this, and you guys have just been discussing the sort of the international diplomatic version of it, you know, surveillance, counter-surveillance, intelligence. But I wanted to just bring you back to the domestic aspect of it, where states and governments around the world, over the last couple of decades in particular, have been trying to redefine the relationship between state and individual. Not just are we having collectivist mentality pushed on us, not only are we having collectivist opinion pushed on us generally. You know, you hear all these people, and I'm sure you've seen it, where they'll be protesting about whether it's Palestine, BLM or whatever, but underneath that, or even climate change, and I'm sure we'll talk about that as well. And yet underneath, they will tell you they want to bring down capitalism. They want to present some sort of social anarchy or anarchism, as I can call it. But you see, the problem that I have, gentlemen, with it is this. A, nobody that I know gave a mandate to any government from any side to be able to redefine this relationship without the consent of the people, whatever that platitude means in this day and age. And the other more sinister thing that I always take a lot of umbrage about, and umbrage too, shall I say, is the way that, for example, you guys were just talking about protesting. But even as a whole, you look at the way people, and we've had it here in the UK, you talk about hate speech. I make no bones about, you know, particularly concentrating on us, because it's been one of my pet hates. Because in 2015, when us, I think it was the first country where we would do it, forgive me if there was anybody else, but I think we did it. My problem as an ex-lawyer was this. If we're going to take any hate speech laws, okay, on board and hate crimes associated with them, what we're essentially doing is we're essentially saying to people that they can dictate, based on their own testimony, what the basis of any purported crime or speech was. So, for example, if the three of us are walking down the road and we see an idiot, I'm pretty sure you two will be on the same vein as I am. I'll call the person an idiot. I frankly couldn't care less whether they're male, female, black, white, blue, pink, tall, short, fat, whatever. If they're an idiot, they're an idiot. To me, the other things are incidental. And one of the things that I tried in vain to tell people, and many others did as well, was if the basis of these hate crime and hate speeches are subjective victim testimony, you are essentially volte-face the whole of Western, and not just Western, known law across the globe, which is on the basis of innocent until proven guilty. And I'll briefly go into it, just in case there are people who are thinking, you know, what's he on about? Because essentially, like the mantra and the maxim goes, you know, even if you're charged with anything, whatever, the presumption is of innocence until your peers or whatever it is that, you know, a particular court finds you guilty, and then obviously there's systems in place. The problem that you had with the hate speech laws is this. If a particular complaint was made and the person making the complaint to any authority or police force or whatever you want to call it felt that there were some aggravating or otherwise features such as race, such as size, such as anything else, it was assumed, because the police aren't going to go and investigate this properly, that the person or people that had been complained about were guilty of, for example, racism, religious bigotry, intolerance, etc. I found that, even on a small level, ridiculous because, for example, when they do in the UK, I presume they do it the same way in Australia, where they may send you a caution and say, you know, we're not going to take any action, blah, 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 whatever. But hold on a second. You've basically made a judgment, which is not the police's role because you're investigators and your job is to obviously give it to the courts who are there to make judgment. You've made an arbitrary judgment based presumably on one side of the fact, and the other person then has to prove they're innocent. Now, I found that absolutely unpalatable at the time. And you could see where this was going. You know, you didn't exactly need, you know, x-ray specs to see where it's going. And it's gone exactly where we thought. And now, for example, you see online, I'm sure you gentlemen do, you know, if there are particular politicians, for example, we're talking about politicians as far as he was, you know, if they say and do dumb things, I'm going to call them an ill-informed pillock, buffoon, whatever. But have you noticed how, in particular, if it's a woman, immediately people jump and say, oh, you're doing it's misogyny, it's this. Mm. Now, I'm pretty sure that does go on, but it doesn't mean that the default setting that you say something to a woman is misogyny. It doesn't mean the default setting you say something to an ethnic minority is racism. It doesn't mean something you say to a person belonging to a faith is religious bigotry. It may be, but surely it should be incumbent on the person or people making those allegations to turn around and to prove the point. And just on that point, I'll finish off on this, but I'll hand it back to you a second. You only need to look, even if we take this internationally, the way you put it, chaps were talking, you look at the way with the Russia-Ukraine stuff, right? Now, nobody's sitting here in any manner of conversation and then going to say, oh, you know, Putin's a good bloke. Of course he's not. You know, he's invading another country and there need to be ramifications of that and consequences. But if you noticed a couple of months back when the main opposition leader was killed, I saw politicians from every walk of life, every country, immediately telling us that Putin had had him killed. Now, I don't know. He may have had him killed. Let's be honest. It wouldn't be the first person. But the ability to just jump to that conclusion, rabble rouse, and I'm going to use rabble rouse rather than use anything else, because I think that's exactly what it was, in the absence of any evidence, in the absence of anything else, and then basically just, you know, asking people just to believe this story simply because this guy was Russian and that's what Russians do. I thought we'd left that behind in the 20th century during the interwar period, let alone the Cold War. But it seems to be the mantra, divide, 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 dehumanize an other, and then get your vote bank ready and, you know, keep on going. I frankly find that absolutely disgraceful.
Spot on, mate. As you were just pointing out what's been going on in the UK and certainly what's happening in the West in general, a case came to mind that happened within the United Kingdom within the past year or so. And I'm sure a lot of the listeners will remember this, and you would yourself, Raiden. There was the autistic teenage girl who called a British police officer. So she didn't call her. She said, "You look like a lesbian." I was a police officer, a short, masculine-looking young lady who had short hair and naturally wearing her uniform. She looked a little bit like a lesbian. Now, my question on this is, does that actually become some form of hate speech because either the police officer is a lesbian and took offence that she looks like a lesbian, or she's not a lesbian, and then in that case, the police officer is putting the idea of "you look like a lesbian" into a derogatory term, and she's taking offence that she looked like a lesbian. So who's the person who's actually got some form of bigotry in their mindset? Either she's upset at that she is a lesbian and got called out as a lesbian, which I find an odd kind of mental gymnastics, or she's a straight woman and felt that the term "you look like a lesbian" was hateful towards her. Now, if I was to go into a court of law and say that Fozzie said I look like a homosexual and I hate homosexuals, who's going to look like the bigot? It certainly isn't going to be Fozzie. It's going to be me for saying that. And that's essentially what this police officer's done.
Oh, I agree with you.
I don't know anything about this.
Oh, I'm going to have to send it to you, Fozzie. It's hilarious. They sent the police to the house and arrested this girl. Six police to drag an autistic girl out of a household based on, like a lesbian.
Yeah, 16-year-old. Well, this is the problem, Drew, is that when you get rid of objectivity and objective tests and essentially defer everything to subjectivity, then one person might take complete offense by it based on their own characteristics, their own environment, their own understanding. And another person might just brush it off. And the problem is you're putting people on the spot, essentially asking them, in this case, obviously, you know, she was ill, she was autistic and had issues. But it's virtually impossible to prove what you meant because there's no obvious, you know, at the end of the day, then it's just competing testimony. And this is the problem, that, you know, you do this, and I will widen it out. I figured we would get onto it. It's not just in this instance where it goes, that horrible phrase that the world uses, and I've got to be honest with you, I don't really despise or hate too many things. I generally try to remain dispassionate. When over the last 10 years, people bang on and on about my lived experience and the ridiculous nature, people say my truth. Well, let's be honest, right? And I'm speaking now as an ex-historian, not even an ex-lawyer. There is no such thing as my truth. There's the truth. And there's your perspective. So this ridiculous nature, and both of you will know that I'm very strict and pedantic on language. Sometimes people get upset, but I just think it's very important. But the problem I have is this goes to this lived experience nonsense. And I say nonsense because they're anecdotes. Every one of us has our anecdotes. Now, I'm sure within those anecdotes, there can be humor, there can be factual material, fine. But once we start superseding or allowing anecdotes like that to supersede reality and fact, well, then we are essentially saying that there are no rules. We're saying that certain people, and let's be honest, I'll say it if you guys don't, there are, within the Western world that I've seen, hierarchies of racism. Now, you know, you can get away with being racist against certain people, or Fozzie alluded to the Jewish situation. Well, let's be honest. You know, you can say pretty much what you want now, which is anti-Semitic in regards to most platforms, and people will take it because, in inverted commas, Israel is the, you know, this horrible nation that is murdering all these people and everything else, and you know, there's no other context, so it's been doing it as an imperial power, blah blah blah, whatever. But the bottom line is this, trucking onto what I was saying about Russia. If the government, and I'm sure you guys had it now, you know, the way they were being ostracized from sport. People were told, you know, you weren't welcome. Abramovich here had Chelsea taken away from him. Can you imagine if Abramovich was black or brown from origin, say, Nigeria or Pakistan or India? Would they have done the same? Would they have? And this is the problem. I don't like this hierarchy. As far as I'm concerned, if somebody's racist, whoever they're racist against, get them on in the dock and turn around and meet justice out. I don't give a monkey's what they are. I don't care what their gender is. I don't care what it is. Yeah, it's down to their solicitor or their barrister to get off a mitigation fine. But this is the problem. People talk about two-tiered society, gentlemen. We've got multi-tiered and multi-layered societies. And it seems to be, I'll say this to you, if the jackpot in the modern world seems to be if you're a trans, queer, Muslim, lesbian wearing a full burqa, which, let's be honest, is black. Sorry, Boz, I just want to finish up. To me, that's a jackpot, and I think that's ridiculous. Feel free, Boz.
Oh, I just said mashallah. I think it's absolutely ridiculous. But I know where it like stems from. I mean, you know, we look at any government. I mean, I'm not against social policies. I think every society requires some level of social programs to bring people up and out of poverty. So, like, obviously, Australia has the Centrelink system, which I think it's a good system when it's utilized correctly. So like if someone's unemployed, I don't know, I'm going to trail off for a sec, but like if someone's unemployed, they utilize Centrelink, you know, to get benefits. But people that genuinely use the system will either get back into a 9-to-5 job Or they'll take that set those Centrelink benefits and make a self-employed business. They might become a gardener or something like that. What tends to happen now is what I've seen is the government has no issue just making a bunch of social groups, a bunch of gender groups, a bunch of age groups, 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 groups to the high heavens, and then selectively fund those groups in order for those groups to be enfranchised to, I think the idea is to enfranchise those groups so they become participating members in the society, which then obviously includes the increase of the amount of taxes that come back through the door. However, what seems to be happening now, especially in the West, with huge swaths of migration from all fucking corners of the globe, it doesn't matter where it is, throw a dart on it, chances are there's a Western country that is taking migrants in from that nation. And these migrants, doesn't matter what color, it doesn't matter what creed they are, and not in all cases, but at least it's happening enough that it's not an individual problem anymore, it's a group problem, is that they're coming into Western countries. The governments are incentivizing them to be on welfare, and then they're not doing anything. And then you've got hundreds of thousands, millions of people that are sitting on government benefits, not doing piss all with it, not going back to work, not going back to work, not opening up a self-employed venture, nothing like that, and just essentially becoming leeches. And what that's doing is it's decaying the society. It's causing the government to funnel money into these programs to keep the peace. But in that keeping the peace is it's breaking down other parts of the system that is required in order to function. Imagine like, imagine if you've got a car or a plane or whatever, any sort of multi-mechanical mechanism. I don't know what the correct terminology is to use, but you only focus on one specific part. Like if you just focus on the engine in the car, you don't focus on anything else. You forego focusing on the suspension. You forego focusing on the brakes and everything. Eventually, the rest of the car is going to start falling apart. Doesn't matter how much you want to polish, and doesn't matter how much you want to maintain that engine. The problem is the government don't know how to maintain that engine. They're not maintaining it. They're just trying to patch up everything else and not realizing that the system itself is actually crumbling from the inside out. But to them, their pockets are being filled. They're happy. They're up in their ivory towers. They're not actually seeing what's actually happening on ground level. That's why they pay the ABC to do that. That's why they pay, all these government-funded media organizations to do the ground level work. But you know that those media companies aren't actually reporting what's on the ground. They're reporting biased media. So there's another issue on top of that, and it becomes this big. And I haven't sworn at all during the podcast because I know Raiden will always call me out if I swear. But like they've essentially just deduced the whole system to a massive fucking pile of rubbish, and they just think that, oh, if we just move this pile over here, everything will be fine. If we move that rubbish over into this pile, everything will be fine. But there's more shit just piling on and piling on and piling on, and the system has to break eventually. It's clearly, at least in Australia, it's on its last legs from what I see from an economic standpoint, from a migration standpoint, from a social standpoint. Everything's just beginning to fracture. And it will happen after it happens to America. I think America's the next collapse of the Roman Empire and the
Yeah,
next, and shortly after that. Sorry. 100%.
America does export its culture, so we tend to see trends. The West watches America, and we follow 6 to 12 months after. You pointed out an issue, generally speaking, that kind of occurs within left-wing politics in general. The left kind of forms itself as the party that stands up for the downtrodden, the people that need
Minorities.
support, the minority. Victimhood status mentality is kind of what comes across in their policies, right? It started off with, say, women's rights movement, then moved into racial structures, religions. The left is constantly always looking for the next victim. And the more progressive, the more accepting a society becomes, harder it is to find the next victim. And they clutch at straws a lot of the times to find the new victims. That's how we find ourselves in situations where we have people of 67 different genders feel like they're being oppressed by society when it's really the most accepting time in history for people like that has ever existed. They're not being lynched in the street. They're not being mass genocided by some kind of man with a mustache and who likes to paint. we're seeing this victimhood mentality put through the lens of feelings over facts. And when feelings over facts happen, this is when we get the situations that Raiden so eloquently put before, that it comes down to, it's subjective. It's subjective in how the person feels and how they took it. Great example could be, Fozzie might go to his work colleagues and see a female work colleague and go, your hair looks really great today, it's quite beautiful. Well, she could take that multiple ways. She could take that as a compliment. Great, my hair does look good, I'm happy about that. She could take that as sexual harassment. Even though that is not Fozzie's intent, that's the way it could be construed. All because we have feelings over facts. And this is something that is really placating into broader issues in Western society in general, that allow governments, whether they're willingly doing it or they're ignorant on it, to gain more power and seed, and we as a people are ceding more of our security, our autonomy to the state because of these types of things.
Now, I'll come back to it, Drew, but it's just, you just raised something which is another pet hate of mine. I just tweeted about an hour ago. You know, in this instance, language is important, right? You know, you're just talking about in the way that the language can be weaponized along with everything else, and I always think that's the core. Take, for example, this story. I don't know if you've seen it. There's a lady who's been convicted of having sex with two of her students, underage, one 15, one 16. And she's going to be sentenced in July for the crime, right? I looked up this story, obviously, with my background. I was just fascinated to see what was going on. And the headlines that I saw about this story, and bear in mind, she's in a position of trust, though it's an aggravated offence. It's not just that, you know, she was just having sex. The sort of headlines we got, which were, and I'll read you out from The Independent. Predatory maths teacher, Rebecca Jones, is her name, found guilty of sex with two schoolboys. No, sorry, she's not guilty of, found guilty of sex. She's guilty of, at the very least, sexual assault, underage rape, whichever way on the scale it becomes. And this is the problem. You took to put that in what we've been discussing. That was the other way around. Say that was a bloke with a bloke teacher with two girls. That would have been rape, decriminalized rape, women's rights, etc. Why are we engaging in this hierarchy of racism, of religious intolerance, in this case, sexual crimes? If you're doing something wrong, you deserve to be punished. Of course, there's rehabilitation. We've spoken about that. You guys have touched on stuff that, you know, we need to have social society constructs, etc. Of course not. We're not saying going back to the pre-19th century and saying lock them away, etc. But, you know, if that needs to be done, fine. But it's one of my pet hates, what I'm about to say to you. I don't think I've ever said it on a podcast, so Drew, yours is the first one. I'm alarmed when I hear people describe themselves as rape survivors. I'm sorry. Now, let's be perfectly clear before I make the point, because I know there'll be people who says, oh, what's he saying? He's diminishing. No. Let's be clear before I get into what I want to say. Rape is the second most serious criminal offence after murder. I don't think 5 years, which is what we have in the UK, is anywhere near enough. I don't think 14 years is enough, because you are destroying someone's life. You said earlier on, Drew, pen mightier than sword. But for heaven's sake, their psychology, thankfully, we're in a society where people understand mental health issues that maybe didn't 30 years ago. The impact that can have, I wouldn't even dare to speculate, because I'm in no position to do so. It would be harrowing on the person in question. And there's no chance anybody could say anything different. Right. However, let's be fair and let's be honest. The intention of a rapist, by the very essence of the crime, is not to kill you. It's to do untoward things and degrade you and everything else. Why on earth are we allowing this use of the word survivor, which is very much or had been about people who have escaped potentially attempts of murder in a war setting or everything else? We can't allow these things to equate. Now, when I say this, Drew, right, people go, oh, you're trying to be pedantic. I'm not trying to be pedantic. You're a victim of rape. That's absolutely fine. There is no need to, again, present this hierarchy as though a normal victim isn't good enough, so you need to say survivor. You're not a survivor. And people misuse and misconceive these linguistic things and concepts and words, and then they just become meaningless. And as we're on it, and the thing that really annoys me, we've spoken about this on Spaces, and I no doubt we will again, people throw these words around, and I've got to be honest with you, I sometimes sit, and you guys will have heard me, I sit just with my head in my hands thinking, do you actually even know what this means? The current thing. So one of my pet hates along with that is the way people conflate racism and religious intolerance. They're not the same thing, right? They're not the same thing. I know, for example, in the UK, both Jews and Sikhs are recognized as a race. Well, that's the quirk of the system. But if you're a religious person, generally, if you're a Christian, Hindu, a Muslim, you're not a race, right? It's religious bigotry, it's religious intolerance. That's a crime in itself, but let's not equate the two. But the problem that I have is you have people, Gertrude, who turn around and use genocide. Now, you know, I'm a classicist as well as a historian. Genocide, you know, in the English language is very much about killing people of a particular kind and going out looking to kill people of that kind. It's not mass murder. The way people throw this phrase about with what Israel's doing, and let me bring that in as well. You know, newsflash, in wars, international laws are often transgressed. If you don't believe me, go back and have a look at any wars from the last 100 years, particularly those horrible things that happened in 1914, 1939. The way people wax lyrical about them and suggest that, oh, you know, these are untouched tablets from a divine source that all of a sudden just Israel's doing, nobody else's doing, is ridiculous. It is virtue signaling of the highest order, essentially about putting your emotional background and everything else you want and making sure that that supersedes any other, you know, particular role or any other, you know, protest, whatever, because that's your pet project. I find it disgraceful. And this is why I always try to call people out on it. I'm like, listen, surely most of society wants ultimately the benefit of humans for each other and to leave it in a better place than when we found it. That's, I guess, unless you're a misanthrope. And I'll be honest with you, gentlemen, people do call me misanthrope, probably rightfully so at times. I always think that's our general purpose. You know, we want to come to a world and hopefully leave it in a better place. But we're not doing it by leaving language in such a mess where racist, as I call it, where fascist, where genocide are just being given these things which make it meaningless. And if we're talking about, you know, where I start with the rape, when you get those situations happening, to me, it demeans the victims because they are victims. Let's not try and flower it and sugarcoat it and try to say they need to be something more. Victim is plenty enough. And the irony, Drew, what you're saying is that we live in a society where people are always looking for victims, but they're not content by just calling them the word victim because that in itself now seems so passé. And I just think it's ridiculous.
It is. It's the same thing with the watering down of the term racist. Anyone can be called an ist or an ism these days based on the smallest transgressions or interpretations of others. An example of this is I've got a friend who's a listener of the show who is an Indigenous man, older than I am. He grew up in Australia when there was real racism towards First Nations people. He often laughs about young Aboriginals of the Gen Z generation because they are so offended by the smallest things. They will call someone not wanting to participate in a acknowledgement of country as racist, where he was bashed for the colour of his skin as a child in school. The term has been completely destroyed in the most negative of ways. Words that had power, meaning behind them, that you used for purpose, are completely washed away now. They're watered down and become something that are a shadow of their former self. It's almost like a slow mission creep, as if these things are purposely being done so that you can increase the victimhood status of groups within society, so that a certain demographic of the political spectrum can keep finding their voter base, because that's all they can ultimately do. All they can ultimately do is form a government based on we're here to save you, not save yourself.
Yeah, just before Foz jumps in here, I mean, I just wanted to make a point on that, Durant. And, you know, as I started by rape, and we're going to get this, by the way, because we're almost certainly heading for a Labour administration. People are already talking about they stats, and this is what other greats mean, particularly. People in the UK, I'm not familiar with the Australian version, but I'm sure you have, but people of an analogous background say the same. And the stat that's thrown about is, well, there were only 2.5% convictions of rape in society. Rape's essentially been decriminalised. Well, what the hell do these people want? Do they want higher statistics? Will that make them feel safer? That is just the most ridiculous thing I've ever heard. And every time, right, I hear that on a radio, I will endeavour to ring the radio station and say, can we just have some sanity? If that rate was 42%, for me, that would say a heck of a lot about society. And the ultimate problem is it should be a high bar to convict someone and deny them their freedom, for heaven's sake, because newsflash, it's the most precious thing that we have. And there was a very famous case here, Drew, and I won't bore you with the legality of it, because this was one of the fields that I did. There was a case of a lady called Gemma Field, in a nutshell, who was convicted in 2018, right? Because she falsely had four men convicted of rape. I'll send you the link later on after we get off to have a look at. And the only reason that she got found out was because she fell out with a friend and sent her a WhatsApp message and basically said, I'll do to you what I did to them, in the sense that she was threatening her. Thankfully, and I say thankfully, the friend went to the police, they investigated and found all her allegations false, and she's now been in prison. Now, in prison for, I think, 7 years or maybe even 10, which is ridiculous for destroying four men's lives. You can bet your bottom dollar, Drew, that those men, even though, you know, they're innocent, the fact remains they were convicted in a court. There are going to be people who say, well, we're not sure about this because mud sticks. And that's the problem. Whereas if that's the other way around, and this is why I get so frustrated, because we have this two-tier society, whether it's men and women, whether it's different races, different religion. Why? Why can't we just allow divergence in it the way it is, to be eclectic and to go off on your own manner? Why do we have to have this? And the other thing that grates me is this, in the education sector, right? You have this situation that we need to teach children to be inclusive. I don't know about you gentlemen, right? Nobody sat me down at the time and said, right, you know, if someone's white or black or brown or straight or gay or whatever else, you have to be inclusive. I was just told, whoever the person is, you accept them at face value, you get to know them. If you like them, feel free. If you don't like them, you just, you know, you mind your own business, that's it. But this is the problem. The government of around the world, and in particular the Western democracies, they have to be in your thoughts, they have to be in your mouth, they have to be in your bedroom, they have to be in your pocket. And you're like, but there's no space in here, because most of us, particularly if we're straight, we've got women in there, and most anybody who's married will know, or in a long-term relationship, that's more than enough, you know, to confine that space and make us gentlemen feel like sardines, if I can put it that way. But this is the problem, and nobody pushes back. And you were saying earlier on, again, I'm sure if you're familiar with the thing. So this is the other thing I've made a problem with, this entitlement society where nobody wants, or few people want to work for it. They just expect everything to be given. You had a situation here where a famous footballer, Marcus Rashford, basically campaigned and said, oh, there should be free school meals, you know, for people, for children in holidays, everything else. Well, where the hell's that damn thing called parental responsibility? I thought, you know, when you're a parent, you should be responsible for bringing children in. Otherwise, you could just willy-nilly, excuse the pun, just turn around and say, well, I'll have 5 kids, 10 kids, doesn't matter, the state's here. That is just the most backward thing I've ever heard. And yet, if you say that, oh, immediately you're anti-children, you're anti-human, you're not being empathetic. No, stop. I thought that was the job. Now, you know, if your parents are disabled or ill, obviously there's a welfare society, and that's clearly that what it's there for the extreme cases. But it's not the default setting. And we saw this in Wuhan virus with all the payouts and everything else. And the whole structure, and I think you were just saying this, is falling and crumbling, not from external forces the way Rome necessarily did, but from within, because stupidity is being allowed to supersede everything else. As I said, and you said, lived experience and emotion is now the creme de la creme, is the new god. And, you know, everything else has to be a distant second. We see that all over the shop. And then finally, on that regard, you know, the politicians, I want to say, because I want your view on it, because I have been watching, as I said to you at the start, with Australia, with just cringe, if I can put it that way, as a place which I used to come to at least 2 months a year for a fair while. I look at Australia and I think to myself, you know, prior to what's happening, I thought we had it bad here in the UK with Starmer and Sunak, because let's be honest, none of them would know a personality even if they were in a spelling test. You've got the geriatrics in charge in America. You know, this is just, well, I'm a younger geriatric, this one. And let's be honest, when Fozzie said he only swore once, given I counted two before that, I thought he was a relation of Joe Biden, as I call him. And then I look over to you guys, and you've got Albanese and Dutton. And I'm thinking to myself, what flipping karma have we all done in the West to have these absolute pygmies thrust upon us, and as if there is choice, because they're a union party, a lot of them. You know, you can argue Trump differently. That's where I get concerned, gentlemen, is that if there's no choice in a democracy, well, why the hell don't we just put our hands up and turn around and say, right, let's go to autocracy? And the one thing I wanted to ask you was this whole Elon Musk thing. And in a nutshell, I'll give you mine, because I want to hear Theo, because it's relevant there than it is here. Why on earth do the Australian government, the commentariat, social commentators, whatever you want to call it, think that the Australian e-safety commissar, wherever she is called, has a right to dictate to the rest of the world what they can and can't see. I found it baffling. And the worst thing was, you know, I watched Sky News Australia, obviously the ABC, everything else. And I was sitting there going, this isn't even that graphic. You know, if you're an adult, I'm sure there's horror films that are worse than this, which show blood and gore and everything else. And yet mm-hmm. you're saying it's too graphic. Why? I was gobsmacked. But over to you guys, because I'm fascinated to hear why on earth people were thinking that the Australian government could become, you know, the world government because of a video that they felt, you know, unhappy was there and being viewed all, around the world.
I'll jump in quickly before Fozzie, if you don't mind.
Yeah, go for it.
I think Australia tends to be, even though we're a young Western country, we tend to be the testing ground for a lot of the Western world. Canary in the coal mine kind of stuff that, like you said, Raiden, Australia, just like the rest of the West, tends to have a uniparty approach. And we saw that with what's happening now with our e-safety commissioner. The very idea of the power that she's wielding was thought up by the coalition, our right-wing government. And now it's coming back to bite them in the ass to a certain degree, but they're not fighting it. They're allowing it to happen. They agree. Dutton, our Voldemort-looking opposition, if you can call him that, came out and said, I support things like this being blocked out so Australians can't see it because it's too confronting, it's too dangerous. Meanwhile, the nightly news can show bombings and things from foreign countries and wars in Ukraine and Gaza and genocides, real genocides in Africa and things that are going on all around the world, but that's okay. Primetime television gets a pass on that. So I think almost that, and this is, of course, my conspiratorial mind and my tinfoil hat going on, I often feel because of these NGOs that Fozzie's mentioned before, these three-letter agencies, these groups around the world like the WEF, the World Economic Forum, the UN, all these types of groups, they put things in place in certain countries to test to see how it will go. They test the waters. Mm-hmm. They get a temperature check. Australia's mm-hmm. a great reason for this because not only do we have a small population base, we're geographically spread out across our country. So if they did want to do something very authoritarian and see our response in a post-apocalyptic kind of scenario, they could quash a rebellion in Australia very quickly. But I think they're doing it so incrementally in the things that they're doing via the uniparty, the illusion of choice, the so-called democracy, that we're a boiling frog analogy in all of this. And the idea that Australia can dictate to the rest of the world, I think, just kind of plays into the grand experiment of Australia that they hope they can apply to the rest of the world. Look at Australia's reaction during COVID. Ours was the most harsh. And once Australia put in mandates, we heard other opposition parties or parties in power across the Western world start to mimic the Australian talking points. We need a mandate. Mm-hmm. We need a vaccinated economy. All that started here and spread out to the rest of the world, where you tend to think it goes the other way. But Australia is this great testing ground. And for the rest of the world, Westerners, Americans, Brits, Canadians, anyone in the Anglosphere, Europe, what have you, look at us because we are the epitome of the canary in the coal mine. We're a small petri dish. We're a great experiment. And I think that's why they tend to roll these things out here. Or to a lesser extent, our cousins across the ditch in New Zealand, they tend to do a bit there as well. Fozzie, you go for it.
Yeah, the New Zealand thing, it's just a micro version of Australia. And I don't mean that from a cultural sense. I mean that from the sense that we're just, you know, the point of conversation we're discussing. Because obviously you look at like Jacinta Ardern and how she behaved during COVID. She was like a five times worse version than like Daniel Andrews. Admittedly, like the lockdowns obviously were more extensive here than what they were in New Zealand. But the policies, the drafted vaccination policies that went into New Zealand were way worse than what Australia was. And just on that, when you were talking before, when we look at sort of the way the nation is, like if we just look at Australia in this regard, because I don't disagree with you, Drew, obviously Australia has been like a petri dish with, you know, with these new modern nuanced policies that is almost like, almost imagine, you know, the WEF, the WHO, they've done what they wanted to do. Now they're at another stage. And in order for them to begin that next stage, Australia has to be the sort of petri dish in order for that next stage to come to fruition. As you said, you know, the policy inlays, the way that the governmental workers behaved during COVID and subsequently the rest of the Western governments and their politicians begun to behave and mimicked what was happening in Australia, really is really telling of where the government workers or the people that are in leadership positions within government, how they behave and how they see citizens. And when we spoke about Julianne Grant, obviously we're still speaking about her. One of the things that was a bit of an ick for me, in spite of this recent video, and to anyone that hasn't seen it, I assume that your listeners probably have seen it, but any that haven't, it was a video of an Assyrian, a Coptic Assyrian priest, Bishop Maramari Emmanuel, getting stabbed by like a radicalized 15-year-old kid. And obviously, as they said, the reason why they're banning is for the safety of the country. I think that is the most ridiculous argument anyone could possibly conjure up, because if you want to protect a society, you need to inform the society about what is happening. If you just start blocking out medium from being accessed by the society, you're not really protecting them. You're just herding them up and like letting them see what you want them to see. And obviously this issue with the video being taken off of the internet and X going to court with the Australian government, the eSafety Commissioner's office, and subsequently winning, it really showed where the government stands on this, where they don't even care. Like, they're willing to go toe-to-toe with an individual and a company like Elon Musk and like X that are very in favour of what, and I obviously have my criticisms with Elon and his thoughts, but the idea of a town square, the idea of freedom of individual liberty, the idea of freedom of speech and whatnot. And the fact that the government is not even willing to consider that alternative of like, you know, maybe we should let this just play out and see how society behaves before we decide to block it or before we decide to speak about it. It's concerning because there was multiple events that were happening. Obviously, the misinformation, disinformation, not days beforehand, there was another stabbing that took place. And what I found really strange, and I'm not sure why, I'm still formulating my thoughts on this, but it certainly would lean into a religious discussion. I sort of want to avoid that as much as possible right now. But what I found interesting is 2 days beforehand, there was 2 or 3 days beforehand, there was that stabbing at that mall in Sydney. And the one individual that was praised more than anyone else that participated in stopping that guy from stabbing was a Muslim gentleman who stopped that crazed lunatic from stabbing a child. That guy, I believe, ended up being killed, and they had a full-on memorial celebration for him. The Australian Prime Minister turned up and everything. But on the same foothold, in the same time frame, the opposite end of how someone looks at a particular religious community was stamped out. It's like, you must look at this individual. He's a Muslim individual. They didn't even make that. They didn't even try to hide that as a fact. They were very, the government and the media was very open about what his faith was. And the other thing, which was obviously a Muslim kid, went and stabbed a priest. There's reasons why that happened. But my concerns is that you're picking and choosing what the society is able to look at. And if you're placating to one individual who sacrificed himself for a toddler, which fantastic, he did what he did, his due diligence. He was an upstanding member of the community by stopping a crazed maniac from stabbing more women and children. But on the other hand, you can't just suppress the negative side of what happens when an individual that's part of that same faith-based religion does a similar thing to what happened literally 3 days beforehand. Okay, he didn't go and stab women and children. He went and stabbed a priest, but the intention of stabbing other individuals and the fact that they've just completely dismissed it, I believe, is because the government are either placating, like we discussed earlier, about placating to religious minorities and minority groups in general, or there's some fuckery afoot when it comes to where the government wants to see the country in the future. Because if you're placating to particular religious groups, or you're placating to particular groups who are then funded by larger organizations, like we already discussed, I mentioned some of them just before. You'd have to go back through the podcast to listen to it, but it's related to the Palestine movement. Is the biggest fuck you to the citizens that I could possibly imagine. Because as I said, suppressing information and suppressing medium from your citizens is not protecting your nation. It's doing the exact opposite. You're making a black market on information. You're making a black market on video distribution. And obviously they've got their misinformation, disinformation. Obviously they've got ASIO. Obviously they've got all these mechanisms involved that involve searching through WhatsApp groups, searching through Telegram groups, this and that. So imagine if they just let this thing run out and people are just sharing this video around, and then ASIO is sending the AFP to go out and arrest people for sharing these videos on Telegram groups and on WhatsApp groups and stuff like that because the government decided to suppress the information from the general public. It's no different to like the National Socialist boys. You know, you dismiss them, you dismiss them, you placate to the idea that all white people are racist. Therefore, there's going to be a fringe group that are going to go underground and begin to grow and manifest. And when it reveals itself, it's way worse than where you wanted it to be. And I believe that if the government does placate to these ideas of suppression of information, all you're going to do is start causing microcosms of underground movements that are going to grow and grow and grow and fester. And when they reveal themselves to the general public, it could be in 1 year, 5 years, 10 years, whatever. The results of that are going to be severe comparatively to what would have happened if you just let this thing run its course. And the fact that the government didn't is another concern of mine.
On that note, though, and this is what I found particularly appalling about the whole, you know, this whole video aspect of it. Let's put the aspect aside that Australia was guilty of overreach of massive proportions, right? The fact remains that all I heard from your media, various parts of it, was, you know, the obnoxious, arrogant billionaire, et cetera, which was not the case because he took it down in Australia straight away and he said, I'll comply with it. But the crazy thing is, right, Meta essentially said, we will turn around and try to take it down, didn't commit to it. It was still up on Instagram. I know from Australian people and friends and family
really? Who are
telling me it was on YouTube. So what the hell were they actually talking about? They were making out as though he was the only platform. That's what I found amazing, Chad.
This is where history is a beautiful thing. History doesn't necessarily repeat, but it rhymes. And there's elements of many things going on within the Western world that remind me of Operation Trust. So this was a situation that happened in the early infancy of the USSR prior to the takeover, where psychological warfare was used to make it look like counter-Bolshevism groups were going around stopping communism before it took over. And it worked really well because the majority of people sat back and went, oh, great, we don't have to worry about the Reds. The monarchy's going to beat them because they've got this group going around and finding them. Well, the group never existed. That was a group that was being spun out by the communists themselves, and it made people apathetic to what was really going on. So in this case, it's almost as if it gives the air of the government is going after the big, bad tech billionaires who refuse to take things down, but they're only focusing on one group because, like you said, the likes of Meta, YouTube, all these other platforms still had it. And the thing is with this, that Twitter doesn't line up with a lot of the Western world at the moment in the governments that are in power. Meta, on the other hand, is very socialist. It goes in line with a lot of government policies in the Western world in general. So we've almost got this quasi-governmental multimedia platforms that send out messaging on behalf of governments. And there's this one rogue amongst the group that's doing this against them. So they are a genuine target for these governments. But at the same time, it's almost like a psychological operation that they're telling the community, we're dealing with these subversive media elements, but they're allowing others to do as they please. It seems like I'm splitting hairs there a little bit, but there's elements there that I think line up quite well, that we're being told one thing by the government at the same time as it's actually still going on behind the scenes.
I agree with you, and that's part of the problem. I mean, you know, Fozzie's right, you nail on the head. We all still have problems with the way he's running it, but the things that are incontestable is within a couple of weeks of taking over, he said he'd take down well over 90% of the child. I don't even call them porn, by the way, guys, because porn is legal. Child porn isn't. Basically, the child raping and exploitation is what I call it. He took it down. He said he would. The previous regime didn't. He said he'd allow people to return. He did. Yeah, there's issues with it. Of course, it's not utopian. But the problem is this. The amount of times over the last 3 years, particularly, or sorry, last 2 years, where it's to do with Russia, Ukraine, I suspect we won't be able to avoid it, but Israel, Palestine, etc. You've got to be able to allow people to judge, as a, if they're a sane adult, what they want to see and what they want to take, however partisan that may be. What I find particularly galling is exactly what you said. And, you know, Schellenberger and Wallace and all them did the Twitter files a while ago where they showed, you know, various governments colluding or asking social media to take things out. I'm not on social media other than Twitter, by the way, so I'm probably not the best versed person to talk about this. However, the broader point is this. Why should it be incumbent on any government to collude with these, essentially now, international corporations, which is what they are, to tell adults what they can and can't do? They had a word for that in Italy in the interwar period. It was called corporate fascism. That was the actual phrase for it. And we saw what Mussolini coded, and we were trying to tell ourselves it would never happen. And yet, in broad daylight, so to speak, we had administrations from both sides of the sphere, let's not make it a left-right issue, from both sides, happily colluding and trying to take down or get information which was antithetical to their own narrative or against it, shall I say, being pushed down because, you know, let's be honest, it was about politics. And the disgraceful way that most of those, if not all of those organizations, particularly based in the States with the you know, the freedoms attached to their constitution, the way that they just kowtowed to what these governments were saying was nothing short of criminal. Because at the end of the day, that's not it. I mean, you go back, by the way, Jen, you know, not just what we're talking about now with the videos and the you know, the difference between the two incidents, even though they're 48 hours apart, you go all the way back to the Hunter Biden stuff. They were telling us it didn't exist. You go back to the lab leak theory, Wuhan virus, they were telling us no, whatever. The gain of function, which was admitted 3 days ago, finally, officially in a testimony in front of us, in front of Congress. And I'm sure there's a whole plethora of other things. The bottom line is, and it goes back to the broader point we're making, why are we having material censored for us if we're sane adults? We're not children. But of course, that's the way we're being treated. And this infantilization of society, I mean, you know, honestly, you said you're splitting hairs. It makes you want to pull your hair out to think to yourself, why aren't people turning around and pushing back, saying to their respective local MPs, to their parties, to when they donate, listen, your job is to have an overview, to provide the overview for protection and safety, not to have each individual aspect and control it and tell us what we can and can't do. There's a thing for that, and that's called theology, extreme theology, that does that. But at least that does that in the name of some, you know, whatever you want to believe, God in the sky or whatever else you want to call it, you know, him, her, whatever. But God, that's not a government's role. And yet that's exactly what they're doing. And I find it not just galling. I find it egregious. I find it incorrigible. I'll even say inexcusable because that's exactly what it is. And on your point there, Drew, one of the things that honestly I think for the rest of my life I'll be forever sullied with by looking at it was that document that the New South Wales government produced in January 2021 at the height of Wuhan virus. Because when somebody told me, I thought they were pulling my leg. I asked them, I said, you've got to send me the copy over. This isn't some Photoshop or something, because I probably would easily fall prey to that sort of stuff. And I remember reading the circular where they were advising, and I shake my head, honestly, but I was telling someone how much I adore Australia and I wax lyrical about its freedoms, its weather, everything else. And then to say what I'm about to discuss now, the advice within that document, and I think it cost them about just under 2 million from memory, or maybe 3 million, your money to produce, was that they were advising people not living in the same household to refrain from intercourse and to indulge in mutual masturbation because we're all 14-year-olds. That's New South Wales. If that was in goddamn Darwin, right, in Northern Territories, I might turn around and say, yeah, you know what, it's Darwin. Let's be honest, Darwin and everything else, we know about it. This is New South Wales. And if they're doing it, you think to yourself, what else are they going to have in store for us?
Yeah, well, this was a time where you couldn't attend a church, but you could go to the local brothel and get your jollies off, and that was completely safe and fine. So common sense completely went out the window. And the idea that the media in general has kind of been this propaganda tool for governments that, I think the Western world governments really shot themselves in the foot in the way they handled COVID, because it really showed the world how they act and how they weaponize information and truth, air quotes, against us, because it woke a lot of people up. And I think it's the realization of this that they did misstep and they went too hard. This is why they're bringing in bills like the Restrict Act, the Misinformation, Disinformation Bill. Because in the past, governments would use the newspapers, the radio, and the news to push their lies. Now they don't have to. They can dictate what the truth is. They don't need to lie anymore. If they say the sky is purple, by golly, the sky is purple, because they are the purveyors of truth and all information and wisdom across the world. This is going to happen. And we're seeing it happen in our lifetimes, which just astonishes me. I never thought that in my lifetime, as progressive as the world is, how far we've come across technologically and culturally, that we would get to this point. This is the type of thing you saw in sci-fi movies of the 90s. I grew up on this stuff as being post-apocalyptic worlds, and it's happening now. It's just baffling that the average person can't see these things happening at all.
It's also in about it's also in about 27 Simpsons episodes as well.
That's positive, but Drew, on that point, not just is it happening or you know, if people are doubting it, during the pandemic, you know, Fozzie alluded to Ardern. Both Ardern and Biden set up or attempted to set up ministries of truth. Now, people just need to have a basic history book to understand what the origin of that term is in the modern world. What on earth, if that isn't dystopia on steroids, I don't know what is. If that isn't ultimate totalitarianism, I don't know what is. And yet people just shrugged their shoulders and said, well, maybe the times, you know, not everyone, frankly, they were blasé about it. They were almost apathetic. And you're thinking, what on earth is happening? Why aren't you people pushing back? Why aren't you saying to the governments that are elected that this is not what is required? And obviously, we're now seeing the whole flipping narrative unravel, because a lot of the things that were being predicated and we were being told about the science, and that you can't question, you're a conspiracy theory, or you're going to kill your grandmother, or the other nonsense, we're seeing it unravel very, very quickly. But those of us who weren't scientists, and I always say this, by the way, when I even do this stuff in real life, you know, when I talk about stuff like climate science and stuff, I always like to tell people, look, I'm not a climate scientist. Please don't assume that I have. I've got no climate qualifications or scientific qualifications whatsoever. But if you're asking me why I'm allowed to speak, I'm just a little bit more educated than Greta Thunberg. And it's the same here. You know, they want to destroy our voice. At the end of the day, it's up to other people whether they want to hear your voice and hear the content. But if they do, it's not incumbent for governments to step in, unless it's inciting violence or, things along that line. But they are very specific, and thankfully, you know, they're very peripheral. You don't get on the everyday streets those things happening. But honestly, guys, with what happened with Australia, whether you had Andrews, as you alluded to, or McGowan over in the West, they were being put up in across the world, champions, as though this is the model to follow. I was just aghast that A, they were Australian, and B, that these local politicians were somehow being, you know, shown to be pillars of amazing truth and innovation, when frankly they've just jumped off totalitarians who took advantage of the fact that, as you said, Drew, that Australia is so disparate, it's so spread across such a huge landmass, and it was easy for them to turn around and cut off, you know, interstate travel and everything else, because of course they were saving lives against a condition which, even at the outset, it's one of my favourite stats to push because it annoys people, that we knew had a success rate, a complete success rate after 2 weeks, and a, you know, complete recovery rate rather, of 98.2%. If you give me those odds in life, I'll take them every day of the week.
Absolutely. You mentioned the Ministry of Truth, or the single source of truth kind of terminology that you used during COVID. That actually sprung up during these recent events of stabbing. So the bishop that was stabbed, there's a lot of information going around on Telegram groups, chats, Twitter, all over the place, which actually made the New South Wales Police Department commissioner come out and say, we are your single source of truth on this matter. If you see anything online, do not believe it unless it has come from us. So that's well and truly entrenched right now within our country. It's up to authority to give us truth and what determine what is true and what is false, because we can't be trusted as adults with determining what's true on the internet or using our discernment at all. That's too hard for us plebeians. So we're seeing this, we're talking about it. Hopefully more people do see this, Fozzie and I, we, like he's alluded to earlier, we've been on quite a few spaces recently speaking with politicians who, you know, to their benefit, have been coming on chatting with people in a digital water cooler space, a digital water fountain for the community. So I'll give them that. But we tend to ask the hard questions. We kind of hold their feet over the coals. And these are people who are putting themselves up as genuine opposition to the Uniparty. And we're not being impressed by them. They're not blowing the wind up our skirts on this, are they, Fozzie? So
No.
it doesn't seem like, and I'm quite blackpilled on this, I will admit that. What I see, I don't have a lot of hope for a political solution. So what can we do in this situation where governments are policing our speech, controlling what truth is, setting up truth ministries, setting us into a world that is very authoritarian in a technocrat type of way with constant surveillance, cashless society? What hope is there? What can we do beyond these conversations? Fozzie, would you like to have a go at trying to solve this conundrum?
The only thing that my mind pulls towards and draws towards, and it's been obviously this specific conversation we have had recently, and I know I've had it a few times in the past, but I've generally kept quiet with this specific thing. But what I believe needs to be done, especially in Australia, I would say this would pretty much go into any Western country that has a two-party system. As its front runner, is to lower the bar when it comes to minor parties to be able to get a foothold in the political circuit. You hear about like the U like in Australia, we've got like these, quote unquote, freedom parties, and these quote unquote freedom parties aren't even registered political parties. Now, I know why they're not registered political parties, because the membership requirements, like the amount of members the party has to have, it increased relatively recently, I believe in the last decade. And now you've got to have, I think it's like 65,000 members or something like that to even be considered to be registered as a political party. So that at face value already disenfranchises people who are just everyday citizens that see problems and want to actually get their foot in, want to wet their feet in the political circuit, but then they're obviously roadblocked by the stringent regulations behind becoming a politician, behind introducing yourself into that political circuit. So that's the first issue. The second issue, which I've rattled on off about many times on a few spaces, and I spoke about earlier, is the transparency issue. And the political parties that are now quote unquote political opponents, neither of them, any of them, doesn't matter if it is whether it's Republicans or Democrats, Liberal versus Labor, it doesn't matter, red versus blue, insert X, Y, and Z, Western country. It just seems like doesn't matter who's in power right now from both the dominant political parties in each Western country. What it seems like is that they might seem on face value like they are political opponents because the media placates to that idea. The Liberal government will blame Albanese. The Labor government will blame Dutton. Previously, it was blame Scott Morrison. Prior to that, it was blame whomever, X, Y, and Z. Gosh, how many freaking Labor leaders has there been in the last 10 years? So I think those are like two major things that need to be focused on, is reducing the bar in terms of accessibility for the everyday citizens to run as politicians, to run as genuine political opponents, and B, is actually increase transparency between government and citizens. I think if you get those two done well, the system can begin to repair itself in some way, shape, or form. There's a lot of problems that exist within the governmental framework, and becoming a politician and transparency, I believe transparency is the number one thing. The bar in to become a politician, I don't think it's a major issue that needs to be fixed right now. I think it needs to be fixed, but I think there's some other things that right now in the current climate need to be resolved, and that is what a Westerner is allowed to say, what a Westerner is allowed to see when it comes to the nature of social media, when it comes to the nature of medium in general, and how that behaves in the physical world. And I think when we look at Australia, you spoke before about like, the WHO and the WEF and all this and that, like have utilized Australia as this like petri dish, as this testing ground. And I've said this many times on X Spaces, is Australians for the longest time have been politically docile. I think that's just the nature of the beast, because where we are topographically and geographically, we are disconnected from the rest of the world. We tend to have a bit of a nuanced perspective on things. And I think that nuanced perspective, because Australia could be considered almost like as a fence sitter for the rest of the world, we've generally been in politics when we've introduced ourselves into the global stage, whether it is a politician you like or you don't like. Historically, Australian politicians on the global stage have always been generally pretty unbiased for most parts. Obviously, there is instances where that's not the case. If we look at the whole Afghanistan war and stuff like that. But generally speaking, Australian politicians have been more or less fence sitters when it's come to the nature of deliberation of two opposing nations that don't quite get along. Australia has seemed to be like some sort of glue that's sat in there. But and I think because of that, on top of the media, the Australian citizens have become benign and sort of not really seen what's been happening on the grand cosmic scale of the
Pause.
social sphere across the West. Yeah.
Sorry to interrupt. Could I just add
No,
something
that's all
to
right.
get your thoughts on this? That
Yeah, go for it.
Australians have got that, we're well known within the world of the she'll be right, mate, the laid back kind of response. We're very apathetic, and that's kind of led to the political situation we are as a country. But we've also got what's called tall poppy syndrome, where anyone who stands out is successful. We're really quick to cut them down. So is there a level of we're not allowing the best of the best to be, present themselves and lead us as a nation? You look at the people like we've got, like Australia's in the same situation as America, if not worse. We've got Voldemort and we've got Elmer Fudd as the potential prime ministers of this country for the next 4 years. Then you look at the micro level, you look at every major politician that's been elected in their areas, you look at them, how the hell did the people vote this person in? They couldn't have been the only option available, surely. Let alone the career politicians who get in year after year who are hated at a national level, I find it very hard to believe that they could continually be voted in with their own electorates. So is it a case of the real standout people, the people who should be leading us, are either not doing it because they don't want to put up with the headache, or they're being cut down before they have a chance to shine?
Yeah, I think they're being cut down before they've had a chance to shine. I can't see that not being a thing. I think once in a blue moon, the powers that be allow someone to come through that has a gravitas about them that is able to sort of pull together a larger audience of a voter base. So in this case, obviously the swing voters. But honestly, man, like from way I look at it, since like 2008 onwards, the level of decay in the mind of the average Western politician has gone tenfold. It's just because, like, the political rhetoric talking points that I see across the West, like singing the same tune, it doesn't matter which Western country it is, has become so normalized. I genuinely believe that there is a vast swath of swing voters in Western countries that have become numb to it, and they don't even realize that in that idea of constantly putting something in your face until you become numb to it has really played also a role in that decay of the society. And Australia is obviously a prime example of that. Yeah, the tall poppy syndrome, as you mentioned. I don't know where Australia can really see itself in the next like 10 to 15 years. I know we've obviously spoken about this, privately, only briefly, and we've spoken about it on Spaces. But I genuinely feel that, like, unless there's a massive radical shift in how the government operates in Australia, and I'm not speaking about the digital ID because we know where that ultimately leads. But I'm talking about the people that are supposed to represent us, the people that are supposed to be making good decisions that benefit society. The ones that are there now clearly are not. Like, I think there are some that are going in with the right intentions. Obviously, the people that are currently in leadership positions, whether that's Chris Bowen as the Minister for Energy and Renewables, or Albanese is the Prime Minister, the people that are currently in play, they're placating to someone else. They're responding to someone else who wants them to do something. And whether that is the World Economic Forum, whether that is the World Health Organization, I mean, it is. Obviously that it is. I mean, we can't obviously play this game that it's not. We've got like, what, 3 dozen young WEF leaders that are currently in the Australian government, whether that's from state or federal level. Yeah, okay, someone go like, oh, it's only 37 people. How many people genuinely lead a state? How many people genuinely lead a state? 50 tops? So if you've got 37% and you've got like 50 people in each state that run all seven states? Fuck, I don't even know how many states Australia has. I should know this thing off the top of my head, but I think it's seven.
Two territories?
Two territories, yeah. I always forget there's the territory. I mean, obviously, when I say states, I mean the territories as well in that. But the fact that we've got these clowns literally operating without restriction, without any sort of consideration for how the general public looks at these particular policies that are going in. And Raiden said it like an hour ago about how certain things are getting put in without the acceptance of the majority. And I'm not talking about the majority of the governmental structure. I'm talking about the majority of the people that pay for that governmental structure to exist. So I think wrapping it all up for me, I genuinely believe it fundamentally comes down to transparency of government to the citizens and how much is accessible by the citizens when it comes to opening up the government ledgers, the government books, stuff like that. There should be something, there should be a platform in place that makes it incredibly easy for any sort of Australian citizen or any American citizen to go into the registry of that government that governs them and see what goes on, to see where the money is going, not just expect one yearly budget where there's an amount that's allocated to a specific thing, and then you never know where that goes from that point onwards. You just assume that it's going to go into that particular thing, whether that's now almost $1 billion to the Ukraine war effort, whether that's over $1.5 billion into immigration policies, whether that's well and truly over the last 10 years, over $1 billion just gone into social housing programs, which includes trade unions and construction firms that work alongside the trade unions and subsequently government. All these things where the government just spends stupid amounts of money into programs that don't do anything for society and actually end up having the adverse reaction of it are another thing. So transparency for me is like ultimately the biggest key to like begin the change, but I can't find one politician that openly speaks about the government being more transparent, because I know that any current positional leader that is in government, whether that's Liberal, Labor, or Republican, Democrat, it could be Trump, Biden, whoever, none of them want to discuss or disclose about transparency within their own government, because I believe wholeheartedly that if there was to be 100% transparency, every fucking government employee and every government worker, maybe not every, but I would say a considerable majority would have some dirt under their fingernails that the general citizens would not like. That's what I'll say.
Yeah, you can't get rid of the stink of shit under your fingernails and they are reeking of it. Before we jump to Raiden, I've got to point out, I've been saying the left quite a bit in this conversation tonight, purely based on that's what Australia's been under, and we've seen a lot of this stuff come from that political spectrum. But as Fozzie pointed out, this also occurs in the right. We saw it under Turnbull in our country. Ultimately, Turnbull absolutely nuked, destroyed the telecommunications and energy sector for this country, all for his own benefits for his son. His son is on boards of competing telecommunications companies and energy, green energy companies, which ultimately, all those decisions Turnbull made benefited his son and was a detriment to our country. So by no means are the right or conservatives, do they get a pass on this? They're all the same as far as I'm concerned. It's the uniparty that Raiden mentioned before. But we do need to get to Raiden, because I'd be interested as a British citizen what his thoughts are to solve the not only the Australian issue in politics, but kind of the West in general.
I'm going to disagree with you slightly. Boz, I think you got a point, but I think it's more sinister. I look at this as a twofold approach, and I'll deliberately jump to the what I call the icing rather than the sponge. I'll explain the sponge in a minute from my perspective. The icing is that yes, was it that there are clearly people who are talented in terms of politicians who, for whatever reason, are betting, or, sorry, are being betted out or not getting the seat or the allocation, whatever you want to call it. But I think part of that is because people are trying to define themselves about what they think are the right causes in the world. They don't want to stand up and show gravitas. They don't want to be unpopular in the sense of make the opinion which, or make a policy or offer a policy which might actually benefit long term if it doesn't chime in with the current vogue or the current zeitgeist as we're in. You know, if it's not the, in inverted commas, the trendy fad that it currently is. The sponge for me, gentlemen, is this, and I've said this on Spaces, and I've said this for a while. I have long thought that we live in a post-electoral world. If you allow me, I'll explain what I mean by that. When you have politicians who are worried about elections, obviously in your country every 3 years here, every 4 or 5 years, whatever, they naturally have to do things which they feel will get themselves re-elected, because otherwise, you know, what's the point of them standing? The problem that I foresee, and I have for a while, is when you have these NGOs who have existed in some form or another since the latter part of the 1950s and various things and grown in influence. For me, one of the reasons why you have a unit party is because although the label name may change, the content is still these focus groups which don't have the same amount of change, which don't have the vacillation. Antonio Gramsci, amongst others, said that what you need is an organization where you don't have to worry about the vacillation and daily, you know, afflictions of politics, you know, being re-elected. You need some consistency. This is what you saw at the outset with the United Nations and other organizations and bureaucracies. So my problem is that the reason you don't get change is because groups like NGOs, civil service and civil servants who, you know, I'll say collude with them or interact with them, whichever way you want to put it. Those are the people whose mindsets are not changing. They're the constant. And so it doesn't matter who the face is. If the team is still the same and the team is going in a certain way, the front head can be marching whichever way they want. Eventually, they'll just be isolated and they're an easy kill, so to speak. And the problem that I have is if all these NGOs and these civil service types, and I'll call them types, are of a particular mindset, they're almost like, you know, what we were talking about earlier. This is the truth. This is the right way. There are, in inverted commas, new age prophets. They're the ones that lead us, plant the way. They're the ones that give us the enunciation to say, this is the way you should be thinking. You think racist, blah, 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 people. Throw into that this whole DEI policy where if there was anything left of meritocracy, well, immediately you have to turn around and look at meritocracy through these lens of you have to be certain white or certain black or certain whatever, whatever. Well, is it any surprise that we're not getting the relevant people coming to the relevant jobs? I mean, you only need to look at any job, gentlemen. I mean, look at the, you know, and I say to people, if you want to see what DEI can do, forget the Harvard scandals, that's obvious. Just look at our Prime Minister, Theresa May, who was elected because she's a woman, appointed rather, and then ultimately didn't really get elected in that manner, if we use the American analogy. And of course, Kamala Harris in the United States, you don't need to go further afield. Those are the archetypes of our DEI candidate, and they bombed miserably. And that's the problem, because ultimately what you're doing is in this anachronism type world that we live in, everything needs to be vetted and contrived and, you know, made to sound all wonderful, even if the substance isn't there. This is why, in my opinion, you're getting a lot of politicians elected who really don't have a backbone. They don't really have a lot to say. They're very poor communicators. And the ones that occasionally aren't, we wax lyrical about. I mean, you know, I'll just draw it over to the side. I mean, people have been sending me stuff about Vivek Ramaswamy and stuff, and he shares Asian characteristics and ancestry with I do. He's all right. He's not bad. I'll give him that. He can argue, but he's not the way people are. And I just think there's a low expectation, certainly towards the right, because the left have dominated the cultural, the political, and the social sphere for so long. And even the language, that as soon as you get someone on the right who, let's be honest, can put a coherent sentence or two together that can argue dispassionately in a disinterested manner, all of a sudden they're the next messiah. And you think, well, you know, calm down. He's a good bloke. He's coherent, but he's not, you know, the way that, you know, the eloquent orator that, you know, would have the ancient Romans sort of rising up again in a reincarnated form and saying, oh, this guy's good. And I just think that's the problem, that you have those two put together. And again, it's been a constant theme what we've been discussing. It's all about silencing the dissent, silencing any diversion. And then when you throw in that, is it any surprise that the type of candidates you're going to get are going to be quite self-effacing, quite meek, moderate types who are not really going to want to rock the boat. They're going to want the continuity. They're going to want to have that because at the end of the day, they don't want to be ostracized. They don't want to be, sent to the peripheries. That's where I think the problem was, gentlemen, is that society is being made to be like that. And then, not surprisingly, that's why it's producing.
I want to jump in, if I can, and I want to ask Raiden a question as well in this. So what you've been discussing is something that I've been seeing in the Australian X sphere over the last, I'd say, month or so. There's a particular politician. I mean, he's not, I guess he's a politician in a literal sense, but he's running to be a senator. Politician in waiting. And he had said something that I was pretty much sold then and there that he's not someone that I would ever vote for. And if that's the standpoint of the entire party, because he is representing the entire party on this particular, on X as an example, this individual, he and I'd be paraphrasing a point of it, but I'm not off the mark with what I'm about to say of how he said it, but it's exactly the same thing, was that the framework, the governmental framework, where it is now cannot be changed. And it doesn't matter what politician comes in, that it cannot change. And when I heard that from this politician, this person running to be a senator, all I thought to myself was like, oh, here we go again. It's just another one of these pollies. It's just another one of these guys that is just being spoon-fed. He's well-spoken, trained to be a lawyer. He's had a bit of a rough upbringing, so he's got a bit of character about him. He's easy for younger people to sort of latch onto. But he himself is literally spinning the same rhetoric. And that's just one critique that I have with this individual. But my question to you, Raiden, is when a politician goes out and basically says, like, there's nothing we can do about changing the governmental system, it doesn't matter what it currently is in its current form, even if that includes the state governments taking a parental role over minors when it comes to gender reassignment surgery, because that's a policy and because that's now part of the framework, you're not even willing to give it a go. You're not even willing to speak out against it because what? The framework can't be changed because once the structure's set, it can't be changed. Well, that's ridiculous. So, Raiden, I'd love your thoughts on that specific thing, not about the individual, but about, like, politicians in general that aren't willing to buck and change. I know you're obviously speaking about that before, but I just wanted to give a bit of context about some recent events that have been happening in Australia and maybe have some expanded thoughts on that.
Yeah, I think there's two aspects to it, Fozzy. I think these people coming to the political sphere, they're sort of drafted in from the cold, so to speak, and they're well aware how to insulate themselves from potential censure and critique. And by saying stuff like that, you're essentially saying, I'm one of the blob, I'm one of the crew, so to speak. So I think that's natural. The more sinister side to it, which we haven't discussed, and I suspect probably another time, is obviously the deep state element, which is a bit of an intangible. We don't genuinely know what level of control the deep state exerts. And, I don't want to go all conspiratorial theorist on this, but those two things together mean that we get pretty anodyne politicians who will say the right things. I mean, you guys no doubt, we'll discuss it no doubt another time, but in a nutshell, you'd have seen the CAS review here about trans stuff and the nonsense that was peddled for so long about trans ideology, treatment, etc. And she basically put it in a scientific background to it and said, no, it needs to be done properly, in a proper manner, not just willy-nilly, not just, ideological inculcation and indoctrination. It needs to be done in a proper setting with medical background, everything else. And the way politicians have been climbing down and basically going all over themselves to say, oh, well, now that Dr. Cass has said this, we'll revise our views. No, most of us aren't doctors. Most of us aren't scientists. We could have told you this years ago, that at the end of the day, if there are people, unfortunately, who do have issues, particularly mental ones, that potentially do need to have gender reassignment surgery or whatever, there's ways and mechanisms to do it, but it needs to be done with a medical procedure in the background, not just, pander to someone's emotions or their hormones when they're teenagers. Let's be honest, we've all been there. you do say, think a lot of crazy things, but at the time, well, the thing was, at that time, you never had people pandering to it. So to me, the thing is, we need to have politicians with a backbone, but that ultimately then comes down to the central electoral bodies that you know, draft these in, whether they appoint them or whether they bring them in, to look for suitable candidates. And I think the problem is, you know, we use that phrase elite capture or capture of an establishment, whatever you want to call it. They are so immersed in all this acronym type world where they want to have the right candidate with the right amount of ancestry, wearing the right thing, saying the right thing about, you know, Ukraine and Palestine. I just think that it's a vicious circle. I don't think one person can break it, but you're in India. You know, we only need to go back to Gandhi and say one person, one of it, change things in themselves, but you could certainly use that as a start point for others to follow the example. So it is that, 100%. But it's the fact that we, and I think Drew said it earlier, we're too apathetic. You know, we live, let's be honest, probably one of the best times we ever have, if you count everything in the history of the world. I can't think of a better one, to be honest, that where, you know, more people are living with all sorts of comforts that, you know, even 50 years ago were inconceivable. And I think there is this element that we sit, you know, comfortably, we think, yeah, whatever, you know, we do, we need to, whatever. Whereas if this was, say, 100 years ago, whether it was in your country or ours, you'd have people genuinely, you know, on the streets, you know, with proper protest, not protest because, you know, they think that their yogurt might disappear or they don't want to eat the right insects or they want to be vegan or whatever else you want to turn around and get to. But I just think it's a vicious circle, and I think it's going to take the sustained public opinion and furore against the nonsense for these people to come out of it. We had this, Fozzie. I mean, you know, with Australia, I don't want to go too much into it because, you know, you guys alluded to Turnbull, but let's be honest, you had Rudd and Julia Gillard as well, so let's not go down those routes too much. But I think we the only time we had it in England, in Britain, post-1945 was Thatcher, where people wanted a change. And yes, she's denigrated to this day. There's still clowns who will turn around and say, oh, Mrs. Thatcher did this, even though she's been dead for how long. But ultimately, if there's enough of a sustained opinion, let's be honest, she was drafted in because she just wasn't Edward Heath. Nobody really expected her to last more than a year. But she made the position herself. And then once she did, and you know, when the Russians get coined her with that wonderful Iron Lady phrase, etc., she lived up to the moniker. You had a politician with conviction. I'm not saying she was always right. She was wrong on South Africa. She was wrong on a few things. But at least she was different to what it was. She was a genuine choice, an alternative. And I say this about England. I suspect I'm just going to say this about Australia now. And in England, our choice in the election is the far-left lunatics under Starmer against the blue socialists under Sunak. And what kind of choice is that? And I suspect it's the same with you guys. When I heard that stuff about Musk, honestly, when I heard Duckman, his side saying, oh, he's an arrogant billionaire, and then I heard Albanese, I was just like, well, what, have you compared notes? Is this like Harvard plagiarism visiting Australia? Because that's the problem. And we need a genuine choice. You know, you can wax all you want about Xi Jinping and Putin and everything else. The bottom line is they don't give their people a choice. Yet, particularly in China, you look at the levels of people that are rising out of poverty, they can throw that mantra. They can say, look, autocracy works here. So if it works there and we're not getting a choice here, you're naturally going to get people saying, well, what's the point of democracy, which would be the most harrowing thing of all.
Yeah, I'm going to throw my thoughts about this and like what are the solutions and like how do we move forward as the West, because you guys have put some wonderful points out there. And I'll often be called a pessimist in spaces for my very air quotes negative or realistic views, as I like to put them, about the current state we're in. I often hear this, and that, and you rightfully said, Raiden, we are in the most comfortable, convenient time humanity's ever had. It's a great time to live. Don't get me wrong. I love my life. I love the things that exist. But there is a however there. The however is that we often hear society's got to the point where it is because of constant incrementalism of 60 or 40 years. And the argument I'll get from people who think there is a political solution is it's probably going to take 60, 40 years of worth of work to get there. But these are the same people who have said that this is the boiling frog analogy. Now, this is my pushback for those people. If it is the boiling frog analogy and the incrementalism which it suggests, the frog's already boiled. We don't have a chance of hopping out if the stove gets turned down and we allow it to cool down. We're boiled. The goose is cooked. A lot of ways, the Western democracy, air quotes, as it is dead. And this is the realization a lot of people don't want to come to. We are very comfortable. We have a great, the many things of our existence are fantastic, and people don't want to have the possibility of those things going away. There's not a single generation throughout history who wants to be that generation at the point of change when it was a negative light. Everyone wants to be the person who stands up at the positive revolution that's going against overwhelming odds, against empires, against oppressive theologies, against all these things. People love that side of things. They don't want to be on the receiving end when it's a negative collapse, because they don't see the positive that comes from rebuilding from the ashes of something that was. Yeah. And unfortunately, I think the West, the Anglo-American Empire, is at that fourth turning point. We don't want to see that because of how far we've come, the progresses we've made as a society, the things that we've done as a civilization, as great and as amazing as they are. I think that's what's blinding us. We've got the blinkers on to those facts, and we don't see the direction we're headed in. And because we don't see the direction we're heading in, we're not willing to do the things we need to do. And just to caveat that, I am not suggesting that we go to violent means for things, but we kind of need to let things play out as they do. And if that means an economic collapse, if it means the West becomes a second-tier economy to the rest of the world and we have to take the back seat for a while, so be it. Times will get tough and we have to adapt and change the things that are coming. Otherwise, you know, we will end up with a great wall, firewall of China and Australia. We will have our speech suppressed. We will be living in an authoritarianism that does not reflect the democracy we've been raised to believe we're in. And I don't have all the answers. I don't think anyone does, but I think we've all given unique individual perspectives on this, on the what, not only what the problems are, but in ways in which it should be approached. So, gentlemen, I thank you for coming on tonight. Always a great conversation with you both. Now, I do know both of you aren't podcasters, but you do have great things to say. And since you are so prevalent on Twitter, where can we find your work? Fozzie, we'll start off with you.
Yeah, so it's just, so there's obviously Twitter, there's Instagram, there's YouTube. It's just Fozzie the Aussie. Aussie is spelt A-U-Z-Z-I-E because someone else took the two S's, bastard. Yeah, so you can find me on those. I generally post on Twitter, obviously, more than anything. Yeah, pass it on to Raiden.
Oh, dear. At least you said Z and not Z. Yes, I'm sure.
He's very Pacific about that, Raiden.
Yeah, I know. The amount of times I correct his goddamn language in spaces. I'm almost proud to say he's...
I grew up on the other side of the tracks. Give me 5 minutes, you know?
I'm not on social media. I'm only on Twitter. My handle is at BLQ28. Feel free. I'll always respond. I'm afraid I'm not one of these people who just randomly follow, but I'll always try and respond. As long as there's no profanity involved, I do. And I'm often on spaces at random times. Probably actually conducive to the Australian audience because I finish a lot of my work in the evening and then get on. But it's just a conversation, Drew. Thanks for getting me back. That's all I want. I don't really care. And I just wanted to say this last. To me, it's not about agreeing with anything I say. I'm happy for people to disagree. But I just want to have a situation where we can do that respectfully. We can do that at the end of the day passionately if we're going to disagree. But at the end of the conversation, we should be able to shake hands. And if you don't want to have a drink, go your separate way. But ultimately, have a drink because we're adults. We're civilized. We're not animals. And I think that's the problem, that too many entities on both sides, they want to degenerate political discourse to such a degree because they want to have a sort of divide and rule mechanism and ideology to suit their politics. To hell with those people. The more we can talk amongst ourselves and cut across the divide, I just think for humanity is just better. And you know, getting on to your point, what you said, you know, about living in the best time, heaven's sake, why are we wasting so much energy? Why aren't we, you know, pooling our resources where we can? We still have divergent opinions, but we still pool our resources and defer to people who are better than us in various things and perhaps offer things more positively in the things that we might know about. But obviously that seems to be contentious in itself.
Absolutely. Thanks for coming on again, gentlemen. As you put it, the divide and conquer is a fantastic method employed by the powers that be, and it's still being employed to this day. But I think people really do need to remember that if you have a conversation with someone who lives next door to you, someone who in your workplace, far more often than not, you're going to have more commonalities and differences with them. And the differences aren't always negative. Differences are, and this sounds very DEI and very left-wing, differences are what make us great and what make us all unique. And that it brings different perspectives to the table and different opinions and conversations, which are all far too important in this modern day. And the only way that we can destroy bad ideas or dismantle bad ideas and bad policies is through good ideas. And the only way we do that is by having conversations. And ultimately, that's what this podcast has always been about. It's talking to people of different perspectives, different countries, different places around the world, just to have the conversation. And who knows what good will come out of it. And on that note, gentlemen, I'll catch you next time.
Thank you, boys.
Hey, everybody, it's closing time. You don't gotta go home, but you can't stay here.